to the Northern Alliance, which had been an agenda item at this point for 2.5 years without any action. Assuming that there had been more predator reconnaissance missions, and assuming that that had all been adopted, say, on January 26th, year 2001, is there the remotest chance that it would have prevented 9/11?
No.
It just would have allowed our response after 9/11 to be perhaps a little bit faster.
Well, the response would have begun before 9/11.
But, yes, but we weren't going to, there was no recommendation on your part or anyone else's part that we declare war and attempt to invade Afghanistan prior to 9/11.
That's right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator. I just have one question. Taking it back further.
The chairman has a question. Chairman Tom Kaine.
Longer than anybody, really, in this particular slot and looking at terrorism and looking at it well. Is it resources? Is it change of policy? What is it over the years? Taking all your years there for two administrations or three administrations even, what could we have done? I'm trying to find out not only what we could have done, but what should we be doing perhaps in the future, because we were beaten. I mean, we were really beaten by these guys, and 3,000 people died. And what is there anything that you can think of for that long period, had we done differently as a country, as a policy, what have you, that could have made a difference?
Well, I think, Governor, there's a lot that – in retrospect, with 2020 hindsight.
Yeah, I'm asking 2020 hindsight because
we have that opportunity now. I think, Al-Qaeda probably came into existence in 1988 or 1989, and no one in the White House was ever informed by the intelligence community that there was an Al-Qaeda until probably 1995. The existence of an organization like that was something that members of the National Security Council staff suspected in 1993. National Security Advisor Anthony Lake urged CIA to create a special program to investigate whether there was some organization centered around bin Laden. It was not done because CIA decided there was probably an organization. It was done because the National Security Advisor thought there was probably an organization. Had we a more robust intelligence capability in the late 1980s and early 1990s, we might have recognized the existence of Al-Qaeda relatively soon after it came into existence. And if we recognized its existence and if we knew its philosophy, and if we had a proactive intelligence covert action program, so that's both more on the collection side and more on the covert action side, then we might have been able to nip it in the bud. But as George Tenet, I think, explained this morning, our HUMINT program, our spy capability, had been eviscerated in the 1980s. And early 1990s, and there was no such capability either to even know that Al-Qaeda existed, let alone to destroy it. And there's something else that I think we need to understand about the CIA's covert action capabilities. For many years, they were roundly criticized by the Congress and the media for various covert actions that they carried out at the request of people like me in the White House. Not me, but people like me. And many CIA senior managers were dragged up into this room and others and berated for failed covert action activities. And they became great political footballs. Now, if you're in the CIA and you're growing up as a CIA manager over this period of time, and that's what you see going on, and you see one boss after another, one deputy director of operations after another being fired or threatened with indictment. I think the thing you learn from that is that covert action is a very dangerous thing that can damage the CIA as much as it can damage the enemy. Robert Gates, when he was deputy director of CIA and when he was director of CIA and when he was deputy national security advisor, Robert Gates repeatedly taught the lesson that covert action isn't worth doing. It's too risky. That's the lesson that the current generation of directorate of operations managers learned as they were growing up in the agency. Now, George Tenet says they're not risk averse, and I'm sure he knows better than I do. But from the outside, working with the DO over the course of the last 20 years, it certainly looks to me as though they were risk averse, but they had every reason to be risk averse because the Congress, the media, had taught them that the use of covert action would likely blow up in their face.
Okay, thank you very much, sir. Commissioner Benveniste.
This is Lawyer Richard Benveniste.
Good afternoon, Mr. Clark. I want to focus on the role of the National Security Advisor and your relationship with the National Security Advisor in the Clinton administration as compared with the Bush administration. Can you point to any similarities or differences?
Well, I think the similarity is that under all four national security advisors for whom I worked, I was told by each of the four, beginning with Brent Scowcroft, that if I ever had any, I hate to use the word, Senator, but actionable intelligence, the phrase, if I ever had reason to believe that there was something urgent that they could act on, that I could interrupt anything they were doing. That I had an open door at any time I needed it, day or night, if there was something about to happen. I think the difference between the two national security advisors in the Clinton administration and the national security advisor in the Bush administration is that on policy development, I dealt directly with the national security advisors in the Clinton administration, but policy development on counterterrorism, I was told, would be best done with the deputy national security advisor. So I spent less time talking about the problems of terrorism with the national security advisor in this administration.
Let me move to substance in terms of the level of threat during the summer of 2001 and your involvement in coordination of both foreign and domestic intelligence. That was definitely a part of your function, was it not?
Yes, sir.
Now, and before I get to that and before I forget doing so, I want to express my appreciation for the fact that you have come before this commission and state in front of the world your apology for what went wrong. My knowledge, you're the first to do that. This does not detract from the fact that there were so many people who we have met over this past year who were engaged in trying to keep our country safe and who have worked tirelessly to achieve that goal. In the Millennium Threat, we knew, and we've covered this with Sandy Berger to some considerable extent, that sleeper cells in North America had been activated and that we had rolled them up and prevented, among other things, an attack on the Los Angeles International Airport. With respect to the level of threat and the intelligence information that you were receiving, is it fair to say that in the summer of 2001, the threat level either approached or exceeded anything that you had previously been receiving?
Well, I think it exceeded anything that George Tenet or I had ever seen.
And I think the phrase which has received some currency in our hearings of someone's hair being on fire originated with you, saying that basically you knew that something drastic was about to happen and that the indicators were all consistent in that regard.
That's right.
Did you make a determination that the threat was going to come from abroad as an exclusive proposition, or did you understand that given the fact that we had been attacked before and that the plans had been interrupted to attack us before, that the potential existed for al-Qaeda to strike at us on our homeland?
The CIA said in their assessments that the attack would most likely occur overseas, most probably in Saudi Arabia, possibly in Israel. I thought, however, that it might well take place in the United States based on what we had learned in December 99 when we rolled up operations in Washington State, in Brooklyn, in Boston. The fact that we didn't have intelligence that we could point to that said it would take place in the United States wasn't significant in my view because, frankly, sir, I know how this is going to sound, but I have to say it, I didn't think the FBI would know whether or not there was anything going on in the United States by al-Qaeda.
Well, the FBI was the principal agency upon which you had to rely. Is that not the case?
It is.
Now, with respect to what you were told, you were the principal coordinator for counterterrorism for the chief executive flowing up and down through you, correct?
Yes, sir.
Did you know that the two individuals who had been identified as al-Qaeda had entered the United States and were presently thought to be in the country?
I was not informed of that, nor were senior levels of the FBI.
Had you known that these individuals were in the country, what steps, with the benefit of hindsight, but informed hindsight, would you have taken, given the level of threat?
To put the answer in a context, I had been saying to the FBI and to the other federal law enforcement agencies and to the CIA that because of this intelligence that something was about to happen, that they should lower their threshold of reporting, that they should tell us anything that looked the slightest bit unusual. In retrospect, having said that over and over again to them, for them to have had this information somewhere in the FBI and not told me, I still find absolutely incomprehensible.
I will have to end it here, although I'd like to go further. Was the information with respect to Moussaoui and his erratic behavior in flight school ever communicated to you?
Not to me.
And given the fact that there was a body of information with respect to the use of planes as weapons within the intelligence community's knowledge, had you received information about Moussaoui training to fly a commercial airplane, would that have had some impact on the kind of efforts which might be made to protect commercial aviation?
I don't know. The information to which you refer, information in the intelligence community's knowledge about al-Qaeda having thought of using aircraft as weapons, that information was old, relatively speaking, 5 years, 6 years old, hadn't reoccurred, to my knowledge, during those 5 or 6 years, and has to be placed, to give the intelligence community a break, it has to be placed in the context of the other intelligence reports. The volume of intelligence reports on this kind of thing, on al-Qaeda threats and other terrorist threats, was in the tens of thousands, probably hundreds of thousands over the course of the 5 or 6 years. Now, in retrospect, to go back and find a report 6 years earlier that said perhaps they were going to use aircraft as weapons, It's easy to do now, but I think the intelligence community analysts can be forgiven for not thinking about it, given the fact that they hadn't seen a lot in the 5 or 6 years intervening about it, and that there were so many reports about so many other things.
And yet, with your indulgence, Mr. Chairman, and yet...
Short indulgence.
And yet, an FAA advisory went out. The FAA advised on the potential for domestic hijackings.
I asked them to.
And had you known on top of that that there was a jihadist who was identified and apprehended in the United States before 9/11, who was in flight school acting erratically?
I would like to think, sir, that even without the benefit of 20/20 hindsight, I could have connected those dots.
Thank you.
Commissioner Kerry.
Mr. Clark.
The former senator from Nebraska, Democrat Bob
first of
Kerry.
All, thank you for doing what I think all of us who had any responsibilities during the late 1990s, early 2000, have a responsibility to do, which is to apologize to the families for letting them down. I think it was a courageous gesture, and I think it'd be a lot easier for us to, in a non-judgmental fashion, figure out what went wrong and what to do in the future if we'd all sort of start off our inquiries with that declaration. I appreciate very much the sincerity of that. And let me also say I feel badly because I presume that you are at the moment receiving terrible phone messages and email messages, and I hope you don't take it personal because you're just caught in one of these moments. I can barely see you because of all the cameras. I'm having to look through it. No, it's okay. I'm just kidding. I'm just trying to illustrate the attention that's being paid to you. And
Senator, I think I knew what the price would be.
Well, you're a smarter man than most of us, then, because I think you can sort of know it theoretically, but until you get in it, it can be quite surprising. And let me also thank you for over a quarter century of public service. I mean, you really, in many ways, are an example of a single individual coming into government and demonstrating that you can make a difference over a long period of time, and you have. And I think as badly as you feel toward the families that are sitting behind you, there are many families that are today unknowingly the recipient of your service, because we did, thanks to you and thanks to many others who were working with you, prevent an awful lot of bad things from happening as well. So let me start off with that, and let me start off by saying that I think that one of the things we've got to try to do is get to a point where we can have honest disagreements and let those disagreements permit us to discover where in fact, we've got common ground. I find, in fact, arguments almost being necessary, you, again, are a very good demonstration of that. You almost always, with your declaratories, provoke a good argument, and it's those arguments that allow us to discover where our common ground is. Let me say that in one area I disagree with you, it's on the Delinda. You said in response to Senator Gordon earlier that it would not have prevented 9/11, it would not have resulted in was not a declaration of war. You weren't advocating declaring war. I believe Delinda would have necessitated a declaration of war, and probably one of the reasons that it was rejected.
The reference is to the political military plan Delinda circulated among the counter-terrorism security group and others by Mr. Clark in late August and September of 1998. Delinda is from the Latin to destroy, refers to the Roman vow to destroy Carthage.
Let me ask you, just specific to the use of airplanes as a weapon, because it seems so obvious. And again, it seemed obvious. It seemed so obvious after the fact. I mean, it was such a simple and easy strategy that was put in place. But in your case, in '96 with the Olympics, you raised a concern about a small Cessna being used to attack the Olympics in Atlanta. And I think it was in '98, in December '98, you were head of the CSG chairing the CSG when there was a big concern on the East Coast about the possibility of someone connected to Osama bin Laden hijacking a commercial aircraft out of New York City. That warning went out. During the Millennium Scare as well, you sent a memo to Berger discussing the possible domestic threats and The quote is that, is there a threat to civilian aircraft? In March 2001, another CSG item on the agenda mentions a possibility of alleged bin Laden interest in targeting U.S. passenger planes at the Chicago airport, end of quote. And it seems to me that we had a broad general understanding that it was possible that hijacking might be on the list of things that were going to be used. And I remember Administrator Garvey, when she came before this commission a month or so ago, all their attention was overseas, she said. I mean, if you listen and look at the documents on the day of 9/11, it just inescapably leads to the conclusion that we were surprised by hijacking. And I wonder if you've got a perspective on how it's possible that we were surprised by hijacking, let alone multiple hijacking simultaneously occurring at the same moment.
Well, Senator, I would distinguish between hijackings in general and hijackings that then turn the aircraft into suicide weapons. There had been hijackings by terrorists going back for 20, 25 years. And the United States had some programs in place to deal with that. In 1996, after the TWA 800 crash, the president appointed a commission on aircraft safety and security that looked at whether we needed to augment our protection against hijacking. And it made several recommendations. Most of those recommendations were carried out, not all of them. One of the things it rejected was federalizing the aircraft searching process that is now done by the Transportation Security Agency, because it would have cost so much money and it would have required such a big federal bureaucracy. At the time, when there had been no recent hijacking, I assume that commissioners on that commission thought they were making the right recommendation. Many of their recommendations for increased security, however, were carried out. But as to your question about using aircraft as weapons, I was afraid beginning in 1996, not that a Cessna would fly into the Olympics, but that any size aircraft would be put into the Olympics. And during my inspection of the Atlanta Olympic security arrangements a month or two before the Games, I was shocked that the FBI hadn't put into effect any aircraft air defense security arrangements. So I threw together an air defense for the Atlanta Games somewhat quickly, but I got an air defense system in place. We then tried to institutionalize that for Washington to protect the Capitol and the White House. And that system would have been run by the Secret Service. It would have involved missiles, anti-aircraft guns, radar, helicopters. Secret Service developed all the plans for that. Secret Service was a big advocate for it. But they were unable to get the Treasury Department, in which they were then located, to approve it. And I was unable to get the Office of Management and Budget to fund it.
But just two-sentence response. I mean, the papers were full of stories about men and women using suicide as a device in carrying out terrorist objectives. The Second Intifada was in full force beginning in late 2000 through 2001. So I perhaps in a second question, if I get the chance, we can continue this discussion.
I'd enjoy that. The bottom line here is I agree with you, and I thought I had made a persuasive case that we needed an air defense system as well as an airport system, not just to stop hijackers at baggage inspection, but to deal with them if they got through that and were able to hijack an aircraft. I thought we needed an air defense system. And we got a little of that air defense system implemented, but only a little.
Put me on the list if we have a chance to do a second round.
Will do. Governor Thompson.
Mr. Clark, as we sit here this afternoon, we have your book.
This is Governor James Thompson, former Republican Governor of Illinois.
Press briefing of August 2002. Which is true?
Well, I think the question is a little misleading. The press briefing you're referring to comes in the following context. Time magazine had published a cover story article highlighting what your staff briefing talks about. They had learned that, as your staff briefing notes, that there was a strategy or a plan and a series of additional options that were presented to the National Security Advisor and the new Bush team when they came into office. Time magazine ran a somewhat sensational story that implied that the Bush administration hadn't worked on that plan. And this is, of course, coming after 9/11, caused the Bush White House a great deal of concern. So I was asked by several people in senior levels of the Bush White House to do a press backgrounder to try to explain that set of facts in a way that minimized criticism of the administration. And so I did. Now, we can get into semantic games of whether it was a strategy or whether it was a plan or whether it was a series of options to be decided upon. I think the facts are as they were outlined in your staff briefing.
Well, let's take a look then at your press briefing, because I don't want to engage in semantic games. You said the Bush administration decided then, you know, mid-January, that's mid-January 2001, to do two things. One, vigorously pursue the existing policy, that would be the Clinton policy, including all of the lethal covert action findings, which we've now made public to some extent. Is that so? Did they decide in January of 2001 to vigorously pursue the existing Clinton policy?
They decided that the existing covert action findings would remain in effect.
Okay. The second thing the administration decided to do is to initiate a process to look at those issues which had been on the table for a couple of years and get them decided. Now, that seems to indicate to me that proposals had been sitting on the table in the Clinton administration for a couple of years, but that the Bush administration was going to get them done. Is that a correct assumption?
Well, that was my hope at the time. It turned out not to be the case.
Well, then why in August of 2002, over a year later, did you say that it was the case?
I was asked to make that case to the press. I was a special assistant to the president, and I made the case I was asked to make.
Are you saying to me that you were asked to make an untrue case to the press and the public and that you went ahead and did it?
No, sir.
Not what are you saying?
Not untrue. Not an untrue case. I was asked to highlight the positive aspects of what the administration had done and to minimize the negative aspects of what the administration had done. And as a special assistant to the president, one is frequently asked to do that kind of thing. I've done it for several presidents.
Well, okay. Over the course of the summer, they developed implementation details. Principals met at the end of the summer, approved them in their first meeting, changed the strategy by authorizing the increase in funding fivefold. Did they authorize the increase in funding fivefold?
Authorized but not appropriated.
Well, but the Congress appropriates, don't they, Mr. Clark?
Well, within the executive branch, there are two steps as well. Within the executive branch, there's the policy process, which you can compare to authorization, which is to say, we'd like to spend this amount of money for this program. And then there is the second step, the budgetary step, which is to find the offsets, and that had not been done. In fact, it wasn't done until after September 11th.
Changing the policy on Pakistan, was the policy on Pakistan changed?
Yes, sir, it was.
Changing the policy on Uzbekistan, was it changed?
Yes, sir.
Changing the policy on the Northern Alliance assistance, was that changed?
Well, let me back up. I said yes to the last two answers. It was changed only after September 11th. It had gone through an approvals process. It was going through an approvals process with the deputies committee, and they had approved it. The deputies had approved those policy changes. It had then gone to a principals committee for approval, and that occurred on September 4th. And those three things which you've mentioned were approved by the principals. They were not approved by the president, and therefore the final approval hadn't occurred until after September 11th.
But they were approved by people in the administration below the level of the president,
approved,
moving towards the president. Is that not correct?
Yes. Over the course of many, many months, they went through several committee meetings at the sub-cabinet level, and then there was a hiatus, and then they went to, finally on September 4th, a week before the attacks, they went to the principals for their approval. But of course, the final approval by the president didn't take place until after the attacks.
Well, is that eight-month period unusual?
It is unusual when you are being told every day that there is an urgent threat.
Well, but the policy involved changing, for example, the policy on Pakistan, right? So you would have to involve those people in the administration who had charge of the Pakistani policy, would you not?
The Secretary of State has, as a member of the Principals Committee, has that kind of authority over all of the foreign policy issues.
Changing the policy on the Northern Alliance assistance, that would have been DOD?
No, Governor, that would have been the CIA. But again, all of the right people to make those kinds of changes were represented by the five or six people on the Principals Committee.
Well, they were also represented on the smaller group, were they not, the Deputies Committee?
But they didn't have the authority to approve it. They only had the authority to recommend it up, further up the process.
Well, is policy usually made at the level of the Principals Committee before it comes up?
Policy usually originates in working groups. Recommendations and differences then are floated up from working groups to the Deputies Committee. If there are differences there, policy recommendations and differences are then floated up to the principals. And occasionally, when there's not a consensus at the principals level, policy recommendations and options or differences go to the president. And the president makes these kinds of decisions by law. In fact, many of the kinds of decisions you're talking about can only be made by the president.
And you said that the strategy changed from one of rollback with Al-Qaeda over the course of 5 years, which it had been, which I presume is the Clinton policy, to a new strategy that called for the rapid elimination of Al-Qaeda. That is, in fact, the timeline. Is that correct?
It is, but it requires a bit of elaboration. As your staff brief said, the goal of the Delenda plan was to roll back Al-Qaeda over the course of 3 to 5 years so that it was just a nub of an organization like Abu Nidal that didn't threaten the United States. I tried to insert the phrase early in the Bush administration in the draft NSPD that our goal should be to eliminate Al-Qaeda. And I was told by various members of the Deputies Committee that that was overly ambitious, that we should take the word eliminate out. And say significantly erode. And then following 9/11, we were able to go back to my language of eliminate rather than significantly erode. And so the version of the National Security Presidential Decision Directive that President Bush finally got to see after 9/11 had my original language of eliminate, not the interim language of erode.
Then you were asked, when was that...
Governor, one more question.
When was that presented to the president? And you answered, the president was briefed throughout this process.
Yeah, the president apparently asked on one occasion that I'm aware of for a strategy. And when he asked that, he apparently didn't know that there was a strategy in the works. I therefore was told about this by the National Security Advisor. I came back to her and said, well, there is a strategy. After all, it's basically what I showed you in January. It's stuck in the Deputies Committee. She said she would tell the president that, and she said she would try to break it out of the Deputies Committee.
And so you believe that your conference with the press in August of 2002 it's consistent with what you've said in your book and what you've said in press interviews the last 5 days about your book.
I do. I think that the thing that's obviously bothering you is the tenor and the tone. And I've tried to explain to you, sir, that when you're on the staff of the President of the United States, you try to make his policies look as good as possible.
Well, with all respect, Mr. Clark, I think a lot of things beyond the tenor and the tone bother me about this. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Governor. Commissioner Gorelick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Mr. Clark, for your testimony today. You have talked about a plan that you presented to
this
Dr.
This is Commissioner
Rice,
Jamie Gorelick.
Immediately upon her becoming National Security Advisor, and that in response to questions from Commissioner Gordon, you said that elements of that plan, which were developed by you and your staff at the end of 2000, many elements became part of what was then called NSPD 9, or what ultimately became NSPD 9. When Dr. Rice writes in the Washington Post, no Al-Qaeda plan was turned over to the new administration, is that true?
No, I think what is true is what your staff found by going through the documents and what your staff briefing says, which is that early in the administration, within days of the Bush administration coming into office, that we gave them two documents. One, and in fact I briefed Dr. Rice on this even before they came into office. One was the original Delenda plan from 1998, and the other document was the update that we did following the Cole attack, which had as part of it a number of decisions that had to be taken, so that she characterizes it as a series of options rather than a plan. I'd like to think of it as a plan with a series of options, but I think we're getting into semantic differences.
Thank you. I'd like to turn to NSPD 9, the document that was wending its way through the process up until September 4th. The document is classified, so I can only speak of it in generalities. But as I understand it, it had three stages, which were to take place over, according to Steve Hadley, the Deputy National Security Advisor, over a period of 3 years. The first stage was we would warn the Taliban. Mm-hmm. The second stage was we would pressure the Taliban. And the third stage was that we would look for ways to oust the Taliban based upon individuals on the ground other than ourselves, at the same time making military contingency plans. Is that correct?
Well, that's right. Well, the military contingency plans had always been around, but there's nothing in the original draft NSPD that was approved by the principals to suggest U.S. forces would be sent into Afghanistan on the ground.
And the covert, in addition to that, Director Tenet was asked to draft anew some additional covert action authorities. Is that right?
That's right, in part because Mr. Hadley found the existing six memorandums of covert action authority to be Talmudic. It's actually, I think, Mr. Hadley who gets credit for that word. But it wasn't really meant to expand them significantly other than providing aid, direct aid, to Afghan factions.
Now, you have just described then the skeleton, if you will, of what was approved by the administration as of September 4th, and we know that no further action was taken before September 11th. And so I would read to you, and these are questions I would have put to Dr. Rice had she been here, and I will put to her the White House designee, Secretary Armitage. She says, our strategy, she says, which was expected to take years, marshaled all elements of national power to take down the network, not just respond to individual attacks with law enforcement measures. Our plan called for military options to attack Al-Qaeda and Taliban leadership, ground forces and other targets, taking the fight to the enemy where he lived. Is that an accurate statement in your view?
No, it's not.
In addition to the items that were left hanging during this period of time that we've talked about, in your view, the Predator, the issue of aid to the Northern Alliance, the response to the coal. The other item that we have heard about that was deferred until the policy emerged was the action on the set of covert authorities or the draft of covert authorities that Director Tenet supplied to the NSC in, I believe it was March of 01. Is that true?
Yes.
And no action was taken on those until after 9/11. Is that correct?
That's correct.
After the millennium, you were asked by Sandy Berger, and he testified about it this morning, to do an after-action report. And he described how there were 29 recommendations and a huge supplemental, et cetera.
Oh, thank you.
The report doesn't address some of the systemic issues. And you, above maybe anybody else, saw the systemic problems. I mean, you have described yourself the problems with the FBI, the wall between the FBI and the CIA. We've heard about the disconnect between the State Department watch list and the FAA no-fly list. We've heard about really the inadequacy of our visa program and the consular effort. So my question for you is this. You had a great shot after the millennium to take a whack at these problems, which you no doubt must have seen, or maybe I'll give you the benefit of the doubt, perhaps there's some you hadn't seen. Why was the after-action report post-millennium as modest as it was? Why didn't it address these fissures and these gaps in the system?
Well, it made 28 or 29 recommendations. Had all of those recommendations been easy to do, they would have been implemented before or after the after-action report. Many of the 28 or 29 recommendations were implemented, but some of them weren't, because we went pretty far in the art of the practical, the art of the possible, with those recommendations. And that's probably why some of them never got done, and some of them still haven't been done. I've learned over time that if you go for the perfect solution, the best solution, you don't get very far in actually achieving things. You can write nice reports if you're at the Brookings Commission or something, but if you want to get something done in the real world, you do what is doable and you try to do a little bit more, but you don't shoot for the moon. And I think some of the systemic things that are obvious to you, and I know they are, were more practical after 9/11 than they were after the millennium. Remember, in the millennium, we succeeded in stopping the attacks. That was good news, but it was not good news for those of us who also wanted to put pressure on the Congress and pressure on OMB and other places. Because we were not able to point to, and I hate to say this, body bags. You know, unfortunately, this country takes body bags. It requires body bags sometimes to make really tough decisions about money and about governmental arrangements. And one of the things I would hope that comes out of your commission report is a change, a recommendation for a change in the attitude of government about threats, that we be able to act on threats that we foresee. Even if acting requires boldness and requires money and requires changing the way we do business, that we act on threats in the future before they happen. The problem is that when you make that recommendation before they happen, when you recommend an air defense system for Washington before there's been a 9/11, people tend to think you're nuts. And I got a lot of that. You know, when the Clinton administration ended, 35 Americans had died at the hands of al-Qaeda over the course of 8 years. And a lot of people said, behind my back and some of them to my face, why are you so obsessed with this organization? It's only killed 35 Americans over the course of 8 years. Why are you making such a big deal over this organization? That's the kind of mindset that made it difficult for us, even though the president, the national security advisor, and others, the DCI, knew there was a problem and were supporting me. But the institutional bureaucracy in the FBI and in DOD and in CIA and in OMB and on the Hill, because I spent a lot of time up here trying to get money and trying to get change authorities, couldn't see the threat because it hadn't happened.
Well, that's a very sobering statement, particularly from someone who, whose reputation is as aggressive as your reputation is, and it makes me think that individuals with who are less of a pile driver, to use Sandy Berger's words, must feel even less able to push for change. Thank you.
Secretary Lehman.
Thank you.
John Lehman.
Since you and I first served 28 years ago in the MBFR
Secretary
delegation, I have genuinely been a fan of yours. I've watched you labor without fear or favor in the in a succession of jobs where you really made a difference. And so when you agreed to spend as much time as you did with us in, as you say, 15 hours, I was very hopeful. And I attended one of those all-day sessions and read the other two transcripts, and I thought they were terrific. I thought, here we have a guy who can be the Rosetta Stone for helping this commission do its job, to help to have the American people grasp what the dysfunctional problems in this government are. And I thought you let the chips fall where they may. You made a few value judgments, which could be debated, but by and large, you were critical of the things, institutions, and people that could have done better and some that did very badly. Certainly the greater weight of this criticism fell during the Clinton years, simply because there were eight of them and only 7.5 months of the Bush years. I don't think you, in the transcripts that we have of your classified interviews, pulled punches in either direction. And frankly, a lot of my questioning this past 2 days has been drawn from some of the things that you articulated so well during the Clinton years, particularly because they stretched from the first, as you pointed out, attempt by Saddam to assassinate President Bush 41 right up through the end of the administration. But now we have the book. And I've published books, and I must say I am green with envy at the promotion department of your publisher. I never got Jim Thompson to stand before 50 photographers reading your book. And I certainly never got 60 Minutes to coordinate the showing of its interview with you with 15 network news broadcasts, the selling of the movie rights, and your appearance here today. So I would say bravo. Until I started reading those press reports. And I said, this can't be the same Dick Clark that testified before us, because all of the promotional material and all of the spin in the networks was that this is a rounding, devastating attack, this book, on President Bush. That's not what I heard in the interviews. And I hope you're going to tell me, as you apologize to the families for all of us who were involved in national security, that this tremendous difference, and not just in nuance, but in what it is you choose to, the stories you choose to tell, is really the result of your editors and your promoters rather than your studied judgment, because it is so different from the whole thrust of your testimony to us. And similarly, when you add to it the inconsistency between what your promoters are putting out and what you yourself said as late as August 05, you've got a real credibility problem. And because of my real genuine long-term admiration for you, I hope you'll resolve that credibility problem, because I'd hate to see you become totally shoved to one side during a presidential campaign as an active partisan selling a book.
Thank you, John. Let me talk about partisanship here, since you raise it. I've been accused of being a member of John Kerry's campaign team several times this week, including by the White House. So let's just lay that one to bed. I'm not working for the Kerry campaign. Last time I had to declare my party loyalty, it was to vote in the Virginia primary for President of the United States in the year 2000, and I asked for a Republican ballot. I worked for Ronald Reagan with you. I worked for the first President Bush, and he nominated me to the Senate as an Assistant Secretary of State, and I worked in his White House, and I've worked for this President Bush. And I'm not working for Senator Kerry. Now, the fact of the matter is, I do co-teach a class with someone who works for Senator Kerry. That person is named Randy Beers. Randy Beers and I have worked together in the federal government, in the White House, in the State Department for 25 years. Randy Beers worked in the White House for Ronald Reagan. Randy Beers worked in the White House for the first President Bush. And Randy Beers worked in the White House for the second President Bush. And just because he is now working for Senator Kerry, I am not going to disassociate myself from one of my best friends and someone who I greatly respect and have worked with for 25 years. And yes, I will admit I co-teach a class at the Harvard University and the Georgetown University with Mr. Beers. That, I don't think, makes me a member of the Kerry campaign. The White House has said that my book is an audition for a high-level position in the Kerry campaign. So let me say here, as I am under oath, that I will not accept any position in the Kerry administration, should there be one, on the record, under oath. Now, as to your accusation that there is a difference between what I said to this commission in 15 hours of testimony and what I am saying in my book, and what